It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, jean sales are tanking as we're embracing the most comfortable items in our closet. We talk with a retail reporter about peak pandemic fashion. First, Kenosha has been the latest center point for issues of policing and racial justice after a police officer shot Jacob Blake. The city has seen peaceful demonstrations as well as looting and the presence of armed counter-protesters, one of whom is a white teenager accused of killing two people at the demonstrations. This tension, these cycles of protest and violence, they aren't new. And while this year's events have drawn comparisons to the unrest of the 1960s, our next guest says there's a deeper history going back to the 1940s and the 1920s that tells us about our current moment. Thomas Sugrue is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University, where he directs the NYU Collaborative on Global Urbanism. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Before we really get into those comparisons, overall, what do we lose if we aren't thinking about history when we talk about the events of the past several months, the past several days?
Well, there's a tendency to look at current events as singular, as something that just happened now that's the result of current circumstances. But to understand the uprisings that have broken out in the U.S. and worldwide since May around Black Lives Matter and most recently in Kenosha, we have to put it in the context of a couple centuries long struggle by African Americans against police repression, going back to slave patrols and intensifying in the 20th century as Northern whites reacted violently and Northern police reacted violently to African Americans who were migrating to cities. So the history is a deep and long one.
You write that one time we should look at starts in the so-called Red Summer of 1919. And a few years after that, it was a strikingly violent time. What did we see across the country then?
Well, the country was in real turmoil in the late teens and early 1920s. It was a period of intense racial and gender tensions, of anti-immigration sentiment. The Spanish flu epidemic ravaged the United States in that period. But most of all, clashes between whites and African Americans played out because it was the beginning of the so-called Great Migration, or the mass movement of African Americans into cities around the country, in the South and West, but especially in the North. And so we saw clashes between whites, mostly fiercely opposing African Americans moving into jobs that they consider to be white jobs in the defense industry, or moving into neighborhoods that were perceived as white turf and white neighborhoods. So Chicago in 1919 is a good example of that, where mobs of whites attacked African Americans on the streets, resisting their migration to the city and trying to assert their power over African American bodies.
And 100 years ago, where were the police when this was happening?
The police often took the side of the violent whites who were attacking African Americans, or turned a blind eye toward what whites were doing. In some cases, white vigilantes worked with the cooperation of the police. One of the most violent uprisings in that period was 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where white vigilantes attacked the African-American business district, Greenwood, or known as the Black Wall Street, killing about 300 people and displacing almost the entire Black population of Tulsa and burning down almost all the African-American-owned businesses there. And police arrested African-Americans who defended themselves, which was a pretty common police tactic in that period. Let the whites run rampant, but arrest African-Americans whenever they tried to defend themselves against white violence.
Did that change the strategy then of Black groups and organizing coming out of that, if that was what they were up against?
Well, during the period from the 1920s up through the 1940s, there was growing mobilization by African-Americans to demand racial equality, to push for civil rights. And that meant Groups like the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which had been founded in 1909, mobilizing to abolish lynching, for example, or beginning to mobilize in the 1920s and especially during the 1930s and 40s to open up jobs on an equal basis for African Americans in American industry. And increasingly in the 40s and 50s, pushing for equal opportunity in housing, which was one of the major areas of racial inequality in that period, all growing out of responses to this long period of racial inequality in the North, especially.
Thomas Sugrue is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234 as we talk about the long history when it comes to demonstrations for racial justice. What do you think the first step is to preventing further tension today? Maybe you've taken part in protests now or at any point in the past. What do you think we should know? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Thomas, you're from Detroit. The city's 1967 riots are well known, but it was also one of the cities where race riots happened in the 40s. What characterized this period of unrest?
The 1940s was another era of intense competition between whites and African Americans. It was the Second World War. Black migration to northern cities like Detroit intensified a great deal. Whites would walk out of jobs on assembly lines to protest the first African-American or even the placement of a single African-American in a particular job category that had been all white. They were called hate strikes. And also during that period, there were intense clashes over the movement of the first or second African-American household into a formerly all white neighborhood. And so the 43 uprisings in Detroit were an example similar to that, what we saw in the Red Summers of 1919 and the early 20s, which is whites rising to defend, as they saw it, their neighborhoods against what they considered to be the invasion of African Americans. And so in Detroit in 43, whites yanked African Americans off of buses and streetcars and beat them up. They attacked African Americans in the streets. They marauded in African American business districts. All as ways of trying to assert their power over the city's growing black population and to try to push them back into a position of inequality. And here, too, the police were largely complicit with the whites who took to the streets, mostly arresting African-Americans and sometimes killing African-Americans as well. 34 people died in the Detroit uprising in 1943.
Yet 25 of them were black and 17 were killed by police. How often did the actions of police spark some of the violence in the streets that we're talking about?
Police violence was one of the biggest and most significant unresolved issues over the course of the long 20th century and into the 21st. In the 1960s, in Detroit and almost all of the hundreds of places that exploded in uprisings or rebellions or riots, as they were called, almost all of them were sparked by an incident between an African-American and the police. In Detroit, it was a police raid on a so-called blind pig or an illegal after-hours bar where folks had gathered to have a party for a young African-American man about to go off to Vietnam to fight in the war. In Chicago, clashes broke out on the city's west side when African-Americans played in fire hydrants on the street during a hot summer and were arrested for so doing. In Philadelphia and in Los Angeles in 1964, uprisings began after police stops of African-American motorists and the spread of rumors that the police had either attacked or killed those African-American drivers. And so nearly every major uprising in the 60s was sparked by a confrontation between the police and an African-American or group of African-Americans.
We're talking with Thomas Sugrue right now, historian and professor at NYU. We're discussing the history of protests and the violence that it's accompanied it in different points throughout the 20th century. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What question do you have about the history of racial justice movements and the clashes between different groups? Are there longstanding issues you see as being a common thread here? 800-642-1234. You can use that number to give us a call. Ask your question. Our conversation continues here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. We're talking with Thomas Sugrue, a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU. We're going over different waves of protest and violence during the 20th century and figuring out what they can teach us about today. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history we're talking about or about the relationship between peaceful protest and police or looting and violence? Do you see issues that tie these different eras together? You can call 800-642-1234 now. And we've got Bill from Barnes who wants to join the conversation. Hi, Bill.
Hey, hello. This is a very good show, and I appreciate you having me on it. You know, the Milwaukee Bucks put on a little strike that has to send a signal to professional sports that maybe they need to start working for social justice and racial equity in the country. I'm wondering if you could comment on back in the 20s and the 30s, if maybe the car makers saw that they needed to provide housing in peaceful areas to live for the workers that they were eager to have. And if you see other, if you could describe some of the areas back then where the NAACP got white allies, perhaps not eager allies, but allies nevertheless to work towards theirs, and what you see in this century or right now.
Yeah. Hey, Bill, that's a good point, especially as you bring up different industries weighing in and being part of this. Thomas, what do we know about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. There was long and still is an alliance between civil rights organizations, especially the NAACP and organized labor. And it was really important in the 1930s and 1940s in terms of expanding opportunities for African-Americans and other non-white groups, but especially African-Americans in various industries. The auto industry was the best example of that. During the Second World War, the percentage of African-Americans working in auto industry jobs skyrocketed. It was in part because there was a great demand for labor during the war, but also because groups like the NAACP insisted and put pressure on employers and on the federal government through demands for fair employment to open up jobs in that industry, in the defense industry and the auto industry, to African-American workers. That was crucial for advancing African-American economic status. And that alliance has always been a fraught one. You know, there are definitely been moments and many sectors of the economy where labor unions worked against the interest of African-Americans and for the interests of whites. But mainstream of the civil rights movement and the left of the civil rights movement throughout the 20th century saw economic equality and racial equality as necessarily having to go hand in hand. And so they joined each other's protests and gave each other material support.
Thanks again for that call, Bill, at 800-642-1234, talking with Thomas Sugrue. The 1950s and the 1960s, sometimes we think of them as the nonviolent civil rights movement. And nonviolence, it was hugely important at the time, but there was also a lot of violence, some aimed at protesters, some as part of major riots. How did peace and violence interact with each other during that time?
So many civil rights activists, best represented by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, advocated nonviolent forms of protest to demand racial equality. But just because their tactics were nonviolent didn't mean that they didn't face intense, often violent opposition on the part of white segregationists in the South and on the part of whites and the police in the North. We think of the famous incidents of Birmingham, Alabama, in 1963, where Commissioner Bull Connor infamously blasted fire hoses and sicked police dogs on children who were involved in nonviolent protesters. But the Reverend King went to Chicago in 1966 to protest segregated housing and walk through neighborhoods on Chicago's South Side and was shocked at the vitriol, the anger that was directed toward him and other nonviolent protesters, including white teens and adults from white working class neighborhoods and middle class neighborhoods in Chicago, throwing bricks and stones and calling King and his fellow protesters the N-word. So there was a lot of violence targeted even against nonviolent protesters in that period. And of course, there were also protests that went from deploying the tactic of nonviolence to more militant tactics of self-defense for example, Birmingham in 1963, just after King the nonviolent protesters were attacked by the city's police and firefighters, other African-Americans, impatient and angry at what they saw as a dehumanization of their people, took to the streets. It's a part of Birmingham that we forget, but there was looting and there were large crowds of angry African-Americans who gathered in the spring of 1963 in downtown Birmingham. And likewise in Chicago, in Philadelphia and Detroit, many nonviolent protesters were willing to throw aside their tactics of nonviolence and call for self-defense or militancy because they didn't see their tactics working. They saw white opposition as being intransigent, as not willing to bend or bow or listen. And so at that point, they were improvisational. They tried different tactics.
Thomas Segrew is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University, and we're pulling the thread through more than 100 years of protests, of violence, of calls for racial justice. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thomas, in 9 days ago, we saw the police in Kenosha shoot Jacob Blake. That led to more protests. It led to looting. Also, the arrest of a 17-year-old for killing two people while he was apparently acting as part of a group standing against Black Lives Matter protesters. What history comes to mind for you as you see what's happening in Wisconsin right now?
Well, I'd say there are some significant commonalities as well as differences between past protests and reaction to them. Let's focus on the commonalities. What's happening in Kenosha is a continuation of a long history of protest against police violence toward African Americans. That's continuity. Discontinuity, the protesters are far more racially diverse on the streets of Kenosha and of most cities in the United States this spring and this summer. Around Black Lives Matter. The protests in the 1960s were largely led by African Americans with some white allies, to be sure, but the white allies weren't, in many cases, the majority of the crowd. They were usually a small minority. Most whites didn't care about African American advancement in the 1960s, despite our romance about those who did. Another commonality, the 1960s uprisings, the looting and clashes between African Americans and the police in big cities largely pitted white police against African American protesters. There weren't very many whites, civilian whites, who took to the streets like Kyle Rittenhouse and his militia supporters in Kenosha, or the militias that have been marching into Portland, Oregon. But if you go back to 1919 or 1943, there were white vigilantes who took to the streets and fought against African Americans using violent tactics. So Kyle Rittenhouse and his ilk are very much a latter-day version, today's version of those white vigilantes who were critical players in the racial conflicts in America's long past.
I want to welcome Jeff in Superior to the conversation now. Hey, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. I'm curious, when did police departments in the North, like in Duluth or Minneapolis or Chicago or Detroit, start to hire black police officers, African-American police officers, in order to deal with the racial tensions?
Jeff, thanks for the question. Thomas, any idea on that?
Absolutely. Excellent question. When the 60s long hot summers, as they were called, happened between 64 and 68, the vast majority of police departments, even in cities with big African-American populations, were overwhelmingly white. Detroit's police department in 1967 was about 5% African-American, even though the city at that point was getting close to 40% African-American. The Kerner Commission, which was the National Advisory Commission set up by Lyndon Johnson to investigate the uprisings, made many arguments about how to rectify the situation. And one was diversifying the ranks of police departments. That began in the late 1960s and intensified in the 1970s with the new policy of affirmative action, of hiring African-Americans in other cities, Latinos or other racial minorities to join police departments. But those efforts were met with a lot of fierce resistance on the part of on the part of white police officers who didn't want African-American colleagues. There's very good scholarship by historians who have gone back and looked at the acts of harassment that were commonplace against the first African-Americans or first Latinos who joined mostly white police departments. Often they fought a real uphill battle, and in some police departments they still do.
How do we judge whether we've made any progress, especially when we can sit here and look to 1919 and draw such strong parallels and look to the 40s and the 60s and draw these parallels? How do we figure out if we're doing any better?
Well, I don't want to be a complete racial pessimist on these matters. If you look at the urban uprisings of the 1960s, a lot more African-Americans died at the hands of the police in those uprisings than they have today. The police are not as violent towards African-Americans as they were in the past because of the successful demands of protesters who called for reform. Those successes, of course, were incomplete. There's way, way too much violence against non-whites by the police today. But we're in a different place than we were in 1965 or 1968. We still have a very long way to go before we overcome. But because of the acts of civil rights protesters, of those who challenge police practices in towns and cities all around the country, the situation is different than it was then.
Thomas, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It was great being here.
Thomas Sugrue is a professor of social and cultural analysis and history at New York University. And we talked about what the history of protests and riots going back to the 20s can tell us about this year's events for racial justice. Coming up after the news, we've reached for many comfort foods and familiar activities in the last few months. But what about clothes? We talked to a reporter who says many of us have abandoned wearing our jeans during the pandemic. I'm Keely Bolina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. After Democrats urged him not to come to Kenosha, President Trump visited the city this afternoon. We'll find out where he went and what's going on there coming up. Now, the first pair of what we call blue jeans was created in 1873. So jeans have had a long life and we've loved them. But it seems now that many of us might be over wearing jeans. Despite being casual Friday attire, people seem to be opting for more comfy clothes. Sweatpants, sundresses, shorts, leggings, certainly not jeans. Has it been a while since you put on some of your jeans or fancier work clothes? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you embraced comfort clothing in these last few months? Have you actually spent some money on comfortable clothes? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Abba Batari reports for The Washington Post covering the retail industry. She wrote the piece, Goodbye Jeans, The Pandemic is Ushering in an Era of Comfort. Abba, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
During this pandemic, we've seen the acceleration of some trends that were already happening more slowly. Is that what's happening with our rejection of denim?
That certainly seems to be what's happening. You know, much of the country has been in quarantine for nearly 6 months now. And I'm hearing from people across the country that, you know, they've been wearing comfortable clothes. They've been wearing elastic sweatpants or stretchy fabrics, and they're just not interested in putting their jeans back on.
We've seen bankruptcies in the news these past few months. Is that happening in the fashion industry?
Yes, absolutely. We've seen more than a dozen major retailers file for bankruptcy recently. And a lot of these were issues that were percolating for years, and the pandemic just sort of sped things up. But jeans in particular have been particularly hard hit as well. True Religion, Lucky Brand, G-Star Raw have all declared bankruptcy during the pandemic. And Levi's has even reported a 62% drop in quarterly sales. So everybody's hurting right now.
And so as consumers, we're just spending a lot less money on clothes in general, it seems.
Absolutely. Apparel sales have been among the hardest hit during this pandemic. People are at home. You know, they don't really need new clothes. They're not going anywhere. And they're generally trying to save right now.
We saw Enid on Facebook write, in the summer, our house is warmer than my former workplace. So now I'm more likely to wear shorts. At work, I often wore dresses. At home, I usually need a pocket for my phone. I'll wear jeans again in the fall. Thanks for that comment, Enid. And I'm wondering, Abba, is this just that it's summer? Can we attribute any of our rejection of jeans to that?
I think that could definitely be a part of it. But I'm also hearing from people who say, you know, I never really liked my jeans all that much to begin with, especially like tighter, skinny jeans that have been in fashion for a while now just are not that comfortable. And so, you know, a lot of the people that I've spoken to have said that they're stocking up on sweatpants or yoga pants and leggings for the fall.
Let's talk more about the idea of athleisure dressing. When we throw around that word, what are we talking about?
You know, it's this trend that's been picking up steam in the last 5 years or so. Leggings, yoga pants, basketball shorts, more comfortable wear that's not necessarily for the gym or the yoga studio anymore, but what people would feel comfortable just running errands on the weekends wearing.
And who's wearing this? Because I know that I, you know, if I wear leggings around, I feel comfortable. And I'm not being an ageist here, but my grandma equates that to going to the grocery store in pajama pants. And I see this, I see it differently. I mean, are different people gravitating toward athleisure?
That's a great question. Most of the people I talked to were in their 20s, 30s, 40s. They tended to be white collar workers who maybe wore jeans occasionally, you know, to a business casual workplace. But on the weekends, they would splurge on sort of yoga pants and pull out their leggings, things like that. So it is a younger demographic overall.
Abba Batari is the national retail reporter for The Washington Post, covering the retail industry. And we are talking about whether this pandemic and more people sticking closer to home will be the end of our obsession with jeans. Lines are open for you at 800-642-1234. Sweatpants, leggings, those things in the past that used to be strictly casual, are what's happening in that retail industry? Are we seeing really people spending less money on jeans and putting them into those sorts of garments?
We are. I mean, we've seen the rise of Lululemon in the last few years. Sales continue to rise even during the pandemic, and people are paying easily up to $100 or more on a pair of leggings, which would have seemed preposterous, you know, maybe 10 years ago, but now it's become a real norm.
And what about the allure of sweatpants? I mean, you certainly don't need them tailored, and you don't even have to go into a store. You can kind of figure out that they fit better without heading to a dressing room. How is that working in the pandemic?
Exactly. That's another big draw during the pandemic. So many stores are closed, or even if they're open, maybe their fitting rooms are closed, and people just aren't comfortable shopping in person right now. And so many shoppers say it's so much easier just to go online, you know, pick a small, medium, or large pair of sweatpants than it is to figure out the right waistband and the right length and, you know, worry about whether something's going to fit just right.
Should we be at all concerned that eventually we will likely get back to being in closer proximity with people in professional spaces where we can't just wear a button-down shirt and athletic shorts on a Zoom call? So we might be getting too comfortable right now?
Perhaps. I think there are two schools of thought here. One is that we are comfortable now, and we're not going to go back to being uncomfortable. And so a number of the experts that I spoke to and shoppers that I spoke to thought that we might be seeing more comfort wear even after the pandemic is over. It's going to be more acceptable to wear leggings and a dress to work than maybe it has been in the past. But there's another school of thought that says, you know, we're all comfortable and sluggish and sloppy right now. And once the pandemic ends, we're going to want to put on our best clothes and feel like different people. So it's really yet to be seen.
So maybe don't make any rash decisions about getting rid of all of your dressy clothes in the closet just because you're rotating among 9 pairs of sweatpants. Is that a fair piece of advice?
I think that's fair.
And what about today's jeans versus older ones? We actually have a caller who wants to join us now. Let's bring in Nancy from Hawkins to talk about this. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
What is on your mind while we're talking about jeans?
I hate them. I hate them. I hate them. I used to love them, but now I hate them. They changed them and put spandex and polyester in them, and they don't stay up. And it doesn't matter if you're fat or thin or tall or short or anything. It, 'cause your body is shaped like a cone. You know, you're small at the knees and wide at the hips, whatever your shape is. And because of the spandex stretchy stuff they put in, they squeeze at the knees. So when you bend over, sit down, walk, you know, live in your jeans, they slide down and you spend all day pulling up your pants.
And Nancy, I hear you. I want to make sure that Abba has a chance to respond. Nancy, I think a lot of people hear what you're saying. And Abba, Nancy's saying bring back all cotton jeans. Do you think denim manufacturers are considering the products they put out and whether they should be changing what they've got?
You know, I think they do keep a close eye on what consumers want. But, what I keep hearing from them is that consumers want stretch. Perhaps not all consumers, but they seem to think that that's what's selling right now.
All right. Thanks so much for giving us a call, Nancy. We really appreciate that. We also have Nick from Green Bay who wants to weigh in as we're talking about the clothes we wear in our leisure. Hey, Nick.
Hey. I think I maybe, if I'm lucky, I own 3 pairs of pants. I work in a warehouse, so I get to wear a T-shirt and shorts all year round. It's great. When I put pants on, I die because I'm not used to it.
So, Nick, you are solidly in the realm of let's just skip the jeans. We don't need them anymore.
Yeah, well, in winter, I'll wear them if I have to go on the road, which is very rarely. So, like I said, in the warehouse, it's always a balmy 60 degrees, so it's fine for me.
Hey, Nick, thanks for sharing that. Abba, Nick saying, I'll wear them if I have to in the winter. It's September now. We're getting close to what's being a big holiday, usually a big holiday shopping season. Do you have any idea what our pandemic looks might look like when we're picking things up this season?
You know, it's all up in the air. And I think that's the big question that retailers are struggling to answer as well. We're really in uncharted territory here. It's not likely that many of us are going to be going to malls or stores even to buy holiday goods. And so there's been a huge shift online. It seems like sales are going to start earlier than ever, as early as October, a lot of retailers are saying. And on top of all that, the economy is not in great shape. Many people are out of work or they're worried that they just won't be in very good financial shape in the coming months or years. And so they're pulling back. And all of that is going to play into the holiday season.
How will we know? I mean, when will we know whether jeans are going to last through this or if we'll start to see manufacturers cut back on the products they're putting out?
You know, it's a quickly changing scenario. And I don't think we will know until we're out of the pandemic, because even week to week and month to month, retailers are finding that needs are changing.
I feel compelled to admit that on Saturday, I did put on a pair of jeans because I was just kind of tired of all of the stretch, but I can't remember the last time I put them on. Abba, are you at all interested in revealing whether you've gone to jeans during this pandemic?
I haven't. I don't even know where my jeans are, to be honest with you. And I don't know if they would still fit me. So I will cross that bridge when I have to.
That is a fair point, and one I think a lot of people identify with. We also want to welcome Stephanie in Madison. Stephanie, what do you want to say about jeans?
Oh, I love jeans. And I don't want to give them up. I'm not going to. I just turned 70, and I like the slim-fitting jeans. I'm really short, and I like the stuff that's really tailored. I'm not a pair. After menopause, I lost inches in my hips and stuff. And, you know, so Yeah, I adore jeans. I do like the jeans that don't have the Lycra, but I like a little bit of stretch in them. Also, may I suggest the running stores I've gone to, black athletic pants that are drapey. They're close-fitting. Sometimes they'll have zippers down at the bottoms of the legs, but you can make them look dressy, or you can make them, you know, just with a casual sweater, but they look wonderful.
Oh, so. Stephanie, thank you so much for sharing the other side of that coin. But we have some people, Stephanie's one of them, who are not giving up their jeans.
Absolutely. More power to you, Stephanie.
But it doesn't necessarily sway those of us who maybe say, I don't want to have to wear those right now. And Abba, are you able to hear us anymore?
I am. Sorry.
Okay. Sounds great. No, I agree. I think it cut out for a second. What is the one piece that you want to leave us with when we're thinking about jeans and really all of the clothes that we're wearing during the pandemic? If even we're going to work, we're still thinking more about being comfortable and feeling good in the clothes that we wear.
Absolutely. I think clothing is so important when it comes to just feeling good, like you said. And right now is a time when everybody's looking for comfort in any way possible. And our clothing is a big part of that.
Mm. Abba, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Abba Batari is the national retail reporter for The Washington Post. She wrote the piece, Goodbye Jeans. The pandemic is ushering in an era of comfort. You can find a link to that at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk about President Trump's visit to Kenosha today. A WPR reporter joins us with the latest from that city. This is Central Time, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Tonight at 6 o'clock, you can hear 1A Plus. That's a new program here on the Ideas Network. It highlights the best from 1A, a daily live talk show about important issues like policy, politics, technology, and what connects us all. Join us for that starting at 6 o'clock tonight. 1A Plus is one of the changes we've made to keep you informed and connected here in Wisconsin and around the world. You'll find both 1A and On Point at new times, plus a few new shows and other changes. Take a listen. Let us know what you think. Find complete details on our website at WPR.org/fall2020. This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. After calls from Democrats to reconsider his trip to Kenosha, President Donald Trump visited the city this afternoon. He got a firsthand look at property damage, toured an emergency operations center. He also participated in a roundtable with local law enforcement and Republican leaders from Wisconsin.
It's an honor to be in your neighborhood. It's an honor to be in your great state, Wisconsin. And we're here for you all the way. Some people thought it would be a good thing for me to come, a bad thing. I just wanted to come. I really came today to thank law enforcement and to just really that what you've done has been incredible.
Announced that the federal government would be providing aid to the Kenosha area to help rebuild. He said $1 million would go to law enforcement and $4 million to small businesses that were damaged. He also said more than $42 million would go toward public safety statewide, including more law enforcement, more prosecutors, and additional resources to crime victims. Governor Evers and Kenosha's mayor urged Trump not to come, saying his presence would hinder the city's healing. On the other hand, some members of the Kenosha County Board welcomed Trump's visit, saying the city is hurting and needs his leadership. Corrine Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee. Corey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
This stop comes 9 days after Kenosha police shot a black man, Jacob Blake, 7 times in the back. The incident set off peaceful protests, also looting in the city. On one night of demonstrations and violence, a white 17-year-old from Illinois shot 3 people. 2 of them died. The teenager faces charges for killing them. Give us your overall impression of what Kenosha is like today.
Well, today in Kenosha, like you said, it's 9 days later, and businesses are still boarded up from the lake all the way to the highway. There's been messages of hope painted and written all over the boards, but you can still see that there has been looting all over the city.
Have you seen any clashes between supporters or protesters from different sides of this, or is it relatively quiet?
You know, today the Blake family held their own rally kind of at the same time as the president was here, and it's still going on. And they had some family members speak. Jesse Jackson was here. And what they said was they just wanted to do something to kind of forget that the president was here. They it turned into kind of more of a block party. There's bounce houses. They're having a cookout. They're registering people to vote. They're doing COVID testing. So that's going on. And then in the downtown area over by the courthouse, there is some back and forth between pro-Trump groups and anti-Trump groups, but it isn't, nothing is out of control. It's maybe some slight flare-ups between people that differ politically, but it's been a peaceful day here in Kenosha.
Corey Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee, and she's in Kenosha helping us understand what's happening in that part of Wisconsin as President Trump has visited and demonstrators are still out in support of Jacob Blake. Corey, have you talked to any business owners or people near those affected areas where you say there's real damage and storefronts are boarded up?
I've talked to a lot of people who live here, and a lot of the people that I've talked to have questioned why the president is here. They say that at this point they just want the community to continue to heal. They were afraid that today having him here would cause protests that were going to get out of control, that could have caused rioting. And so I think at this point what the community is looking for is just a chance to move on and to get things back to normal.
Well, and, you know, President Trump made some different remarks. One of the things he said was that he thinks that this is going to heal very quickly when talking about the situation in Kenosha, and says that the government is going to help them from an economic standpoint. Do you get the sense from people who are there that this is something that will heal quickly?
I think people want it to heal quickly. I think people want to get their businesses back open and going. And I do think that I think that people would like answers from the police department, and people would like the case to be wrapped up. And the Blake family said today that they don't plan on leaving Kenosha until there's an indictment of the officer. Of course, the Department of Justice will make that decision, and however long that will take is unclear. It could take weeks, months. So I think the people of Kenosha would like answers, you know, and so that they can begin to move on.
You talked about people you were talking to saying they're not sure that this is the right time for President Trump to be visiting. We also mentioned that some members of the Kenosha County Board encouraged Trump to visit. Are there people sharing that sentiment in Kenosha?
I'm sure there are. There were a lot of Trump supporters out as well in the park where I am right now, which is downtown. I would say it's a mixed group of Trump supporters and people who are not happy to see him here. There's also some other corners in the city, busy corners where there's groups of Trump supporters. Right now I'm looking at several cars with very large Trump flags. People have been walking around with the Make America Great Again hats on. So I definitely don't want to paint a picture that everyone here is not happy that the president was in town. It's definitely mixed.
But it is calm.
It is calm. Like I said, there's been some flare-ups of small groups kind of just arguing about politics. But overall, it's been a calm day in Kenosha.
Corey, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Corrine Hess is Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter in Milwaukee, and we talked with her about what's happening in Kenosha this afternoon after President Donald Trump visited the city. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, two men vying for the presidency have vastly different messages in their campaigns. We're talking about the difference as part of the week in Washington. Plus, late summer has a well-known corn maze taking shape. Find out about the scientific design and how it's part of a tradition here in Wisconsin. And we welcome back a guest who's a food writer in our state who sometimes has some controversial opinions. This time, zucchini's overrated. Tune in at 3 tomorrow. It may be the first day of September, but that's not about to stop holiday shoppers from hitting up a major decoration sale. A developer is working to transform a building in Manitowoc into affordable housing. It used to house the National Tinsel Manufacturing Company. WBAY reports the space is 90,000 square feet. And after buying it at auction, developers discovered more than half of it is full of trees and wreaths. But that's not all. You can also find yard decorations and lights and all things shiny. The developers say the stuff inside has great history. I mean, it's in a place that's built to make Christmas cheer for more than 100 years, but they can't keep the decor. It's not going to work in these new apartments, so it's going on sale. Everything must go starting next week, well ahead of the season, so you have time to plan out exactly how you want to deck your halls. And if Christmas is a stretch too far for you at this point, worry not. It sounds like you can even find a few Halloween deals tucked in between the twinkle lights and the holly and the Santa Clauses. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.